You're listening to the Mango Gnocchi Podcast. I'm Roshni.
And I'm Rebecca. And we're asking the question, what is your grief craving? We are both nurses, grief experts, and avid home cooks. We're the founders of Marigold, a grief wellness platform rooted in food, culture, and rituals.
We created the Mango and Gnocchi Podcast to highlight the power of our collective food stories. Stories that nurture us, bring us joy, and take us out of our minds and into our heart. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Mango and Gnocchi. I'm your host, Roshni Kavate.
And I'm Rebecca Servas.
And we have a very special guest today, Tita Beatty. Tita, welcome. We're so excited to have you. I'm so happy you accepted our invitation. So welcome. Your presence in my life has been so magical from the moment we met. So there's, you know, so much richness I want to explore in our conversation and, you know, the first time we met and what we ate. I can remember it all. I'm so excited you're here. There's just so much to talk about.
Oh, thank you so much, Roshni. Thank you, Rebecca. How could I not? You know, as you had alluded, the first time we met, it was like the stars must have been in alignment. And I didn't even know that I needed you. And there you were. So I'm just delighted to be here. Thank you so much to you both for the invitation.
Yeah, I want to jump right in. You know, the moment we met, I don't even remember what we talked about, but all I can remember is you were describing, you know, this like really silky, warm bowl of rice porridge with ginger and fish sauce. What does this idea and bowl of porridge mean to you? And I know there's a deeper story and like how it symbolizes your parents' presence in your life, their journey to the US, and you know how you're keeping their memory alive. So I want to jump right into the bowl of porridge.
I want to jump into the bowl of porridge too. I'm not lucky enough to have that bowl of porridge with me right now, but oh, you're making me hungry. I bet that's something that you commonly get on your podcast too. My parents were originally from Thailand, and they emigrated here to America in the mid-60s, late 60s. And I was born here in the States. So I am an American-born daughter of immigrants. And I had lost my parents back in 2019. And it was a really complex situation at the time because, one, they died 5 weeks apart. And, two, when they actually had died, it was something of a surprise with both of them. And so I would have to say that over the course of my life, one of the things that was definitely a mainstay, as within many households of Asian immigrants, that rice and some kind of soupy, ricey porridge or soup or stew or something is always kind of simmering somewhere. And that was certainly the case in my house. And so I would say that this really was my equivalent of like the chicken noodle soup, if you will. It was just, you know, it's very simple in terms of it's just rice and water and you just cook it down. In terms of sort of that anticipation of that comfort that's to come, as well as just, you know, when you can sit down. And with this particular bowl of just like rice soup, sometimes it was thin, sometimes it was much, much thicker. And it had just sort of this, just really just, I don't know, kind of maybe not hearty, but like stick to your ribs, just very, very soothing, warm in your mouth is like just warm in your body, warm in your soul kind of feeling. But we would sit around the table, and sometimes there was really not anything more than this kind of, I mean, I guess for lack of a better word, like a topping, but it was just like dried shrimp that had been basically macerating in the saltiest of fish sauces. And my whole entire family, we are not sweets people. It is all salt, all savory. Just, like,
That's why we're friends.
So like, bring that on.
Crispy chili.
Yes.
I'm here.
Yeah, exactly. So sometimes it might just be as simple as that, where, you know, we would just take like just little spoonfuls of this just kind of salted shrimp and place it on the porridge. Sometimes there might be like a pickled mustard cabbage alongside, or perhaps some kind of omelet or whatnot. But very simple meals. But, you know, again, I mean, not only just for just energy, nourishment, but it was one of those, I would say in my memory, one of those few times where we would really just kind of gather around as our little family and be able to have a common language through this bowl of it's in Thai, it's called kalpom. And for me, that's notable because with my parents, I think that I really wasn't able to see them, unfortunately, more in their entirety until after they had passed away. And I think that as I really was contending with my own grief and what they had been in my life, what they meant to me, and how there was just, there were what I like to call these sort of like these big, thick glass walls that kind of stood between us. And I would say that in some patches between those glass walls, we might have been able to see each other. But sometimes in those patches of those thick glass walls, it kind of looks like, you know, the bottom of Coke bottles, where it's sort of, you know, kind of blurry. And you can see a form on the other side, but you really can't make it out. And I've asked myself since they passed, what is that? What stood between us? And I very much think that for them, they were immigrants to this country and their immigrant status. And quite frankly, sometimes the shine of that immigrant status, but then sometimes like the pallor of that immigrant status absolutely followed them from the time that they landed in the United States. So for them, they were the immigrant, they were the other. And I didn't really understand that as their American-born child. For me, I was just like this, you know, this kid just growing up in America. Grew up on the East Coast, and there weren't really a lot of other Thai people or Asian people around. And so I didn't have those kinds of mirrors. I didn't have those reflections. The only kinds of reflections, perhaps, of my notion of Asianness was basically our own nuclear family. And so what kind of reflection was that? Sometimes it was clear, sometimes it was blurry. I would say probably oftentimes, more often than not, it was blurry. But yeah, they were the immigrants, and my brother and I, we were these, you know, American-born kids. And to each other, we were coming from completely different cultures, you know, speaking languages. And even though we all spoke English, we were not speaking the same language at all. And I can only assume this, but I believe that my parents, they were able to see that much more clearly of their American-born children, like how different we were from them, how we didn't really know anything of Thailand, how it was also close to impossible for them to share anything of their home country and even of themselves. But the place where we could connect was at the table. Both my mom and my dad, they were phenomenal eaters. They loved food. So at least if there was any place where we connected, it was at this table. And at the table, even if we were eating something that may have looked sort of spare and minimal, like a bowl of kalpom with this dried shrimp and fish sauce, there was still so much abundance there at that table.
Thank you so much for sharing that story with us. I love that you say that you connected at the table, because I was listening to you and wondering what does tether two generations together who are living this similar present but still so far away from each other's lived experience. Could you tell us some of the foods that felt like a tether between your generation and your parents' generation?
I would say it was things like that, but the other thing too, though, was that my mom, she absolutely hated to cook. So we would all of us would relish for very different reasons. When we would actually be able to go out, we didn't have a lot of money when I was growing up. So when we would go out, you know, it was a splurge, and they didn't necessarily want to go to, you know, like the KFC or the Sizzler or something like that. No, they wanted to find something that maybe approximated their flavors of home. And so we would just drive for an hour to, down to DC. And somehow, and I don't know, my mother was very resourceful, and she always kind of had her like finger on like the pulse of like, what's like the new Thai restaurant in town. And I don't know where that network came from, but that was that she always knew that. And so we were, you know, we would go and we would try things out. And so in terms of like, my favorite food. Yeah, I would say like, I can't stand like basically chopping for 60 minutes and then cooking for one. but I would say that, you know, when we would go to these Thai restaurants and like the things that we would order, it was always kind of like this litmus test. Like, okay, well, let's try their tot man, which is like a fried fish cake. And let's see how that is. Do they put enough curry leaves in it? You know, is the balance of like little green beans, is that enough? And if we were, you know, if we were in a restaurant that had like whole fish, I mean, oh my gosh, you know, they love that. And so it was like, okay.
You would definitely go back over and over, right?
Oh, yes.
That is a very good mark of a restaurant.
Yes.
Because you can't serve like a frozen, you know, old fish whole.
No.
Like the eyeballs give it away. So I love that.
The eyeballs absolutely give it away. And my parents, because like for them, it was as much pleasure to be able to sit at the table for a long time and the anticipation of like the next dish coming out, like, oh, wait, what did we order? What do we have left? Yes. You know, like that curry, that was delicious. And they would kind of just go into the particulars of the things that they liked. And so here I was, and my brother, I don't know that my brother was really quite paying as much attention as I was, but I was just listening to them talk and just kind of, you know, soaking it all in and soaking in more specifically what it was about the whole fish and the very, very thin slices of ginger, you know, that they would comment on and appreciate, let's say, like the skill of the chef or, you know, like the, and so like these nuances around food is also what I think I picked up from just listening to them, you know, give these critiques. And yes, for the restaurants that, you know, they passed that litmus test, we would go there again and again. So the dishes became more familiar, of course, but, you know, it was like, oh, the ones where like, we never went back to again. It's like, oh no, that was bad. So I would say, yeah, like those, like the tot mun, the fried fish cakes, or just, you know, again, of course, like Thai curry. And in terms of the Thai curry, like whether it was a red curry or a green curry, when you could actually hear like the pounding of the mortar and the pestle, like in the back kitchen, then you knew that that was a great sound. The pop, 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 as you know, they may have been taking out, maybe it was like frozen curry leaves and maybe, you know, like stalks of lemongrass, but that they were doing it by hand and that you could actually hear that out in the dining room, like, oh, this is going to be really good.
Yeah, no frozen curry paste from the tube
exactly.
Here. Yeah. As you describe that, you know, what I'm reminded of is for so many people of the diaspora, we see our parents, you know, mostly like struggling, that becomes such a big element of our shared experience, right? Even how they talk about it. But then when they do sit down to eat, when they're hosting, you know, these rituals are so essential to our culture. There's such like joy and pleasure, a way to like decompress and savor, you know, the art of savoring. But that doesn't ever come to the forefront, I feel. Like we're not known for that. Like our communities are not just known as a source of like work hard, you know, the labor, they'll struggle, they'll strive, sacrifice, all these kinds of, you know, words that are important. I think that is part of the journey and, you know, how we can get from one place to another. But I also find that narrative so exhausting And I'm finding more and more of that. Like, I don't also want to subscribe to those as the primary elements in my life, because I hear my mom saying, oh, you have to work really hard, whatever you're doing. Like, I've been diving so deep into my art practice lately. She's like, you know, just work really hard. But I like think about how do we encourage our parents to just, you know, relax and enjoy more and like see that as something worthy and valuable to do and not just, oh, that's not meant for us. I'm wondering, how do you see that in your own life and also in your work with Mezo and how you, you know, curate that element within the spaces you create and conversations you're having?
That really resonates. I think that too much of this notion of the immigrant narrative that is more often put forth than not, and unfortunately then internalized, is what exactly what you're talking about. And I think what's troubling about it is that there always tends to be more of this emphasis on, as well as acting from a place of scarcity versus this place of abundance. And so, at least in terms of Mezo, Mezo was born out of my experience, as well as that of my co-founder, where we, both as daughters of Asian immigrants, of immigrants, that in terms of trying to resource our families, our parents, ourselves, with aging and illness, as well as death and grief, that to try and find more representative stories of those kinds of experiences through diasporic lenses, through immigrant family lenses, has just been close to impossible. And so one of the things that we really try to talk about is this notion of cultural bereavement. And cultural bereavement, it's defined as the experience of an uprooted individual or group of individuals when they have basically migrated for whatever reasons. And that when they, you know, have landed somewhere, that then this process begins, or perhaps not begins, but it continues, and it begins in a different way. And whether that's, you know, eventually of assimilation, there are many, many losses that are associated with just the migration process. And the losses really tend to be very, very fundamental. I mean, they can be language and then the ability to communicate. It's the loss of home. It's the loss of support systems, support networks, oftentimes the loss of practice, the loss of ritual. And considering that grief is a natural human reaction to loss, there are corresponding griefs, a la cultural bereavement. And so one of the things that I'm really coming to at least understand of my own experience with my parents, growing up with them, is that this cultural bereavement, it actually can begin for folks, for immigrants, anyone with a migration experience before they've even left their home country, if that's something that they're considering. Maybe at that point in time, it's sort of like this notion of anticipatory cultural bereavement. But nevertheless, it is, again, it begins even before they've left and it continues through that movement and then wherever it is that they land. And then after they land, in terms of the process of either assimilation, acculturation, or if not, then marginalization. Because there is, you know, what is this like foundational grief, I really believe that that is something that is, it compounds over time and it contributes to this sense of scarcity. And so I think that if there were more ways that both ourselves as well as our families, our parents, if we could understand better that we have been contending with cultural bereavement, that that is actually a real thing, that it's not just the experience of one family, it's actually the experience of millions. How it shows up, how it feels for us, you know, those are all unique things. But that this is an experience that is so poorly understood, it is absolutely not talked about. And then I think that it can be this, you know, once you get caught up into the, okay, now I am here, now I've got to figure out how are we going to make money, where are we going to live? And you it's absolutely natural to get caught up in all of that. But that then, because there isn't already resourcing around the griefs associated with the losses, that it all starts to get jumbled up. And one of the ways that we might be messaged that we can deal with it is just work your way really hard out of it. That might be one way. I mean, that's certainly a way to, you know, engage maybe towards, like, let's say, more of that assimilation. It's just what has to happen. And in terms of also, yeah, feeding everybody and making sure the bills get paid, absolutely a reality. But there is the other reality of what is going on with you internally as you have endured these losses and you might be carrying this grief that you are not even aware of. What are the ways that we can really start to look at that and try to build more of our own just self-compassion, but also resilience and be moving more toward perhaps pleasure as well as abundance is, I think, recognizing that there have just been incredible losses. That's okay, you know, to understand that there is grief associated with that, and that is also okay. And that even in spite of all that, that perhaps with the hard work, with the support of family, with, you know, again, the persistence and the resilience, that there are steps that have been taken, you know, that move us along. But in terms of really tending to ourselves and allowing ourselves to really, like, mourn what had been lost and has perhaps been compounding, that that might be one key to unlocking a more abundant presence.
Tita, I think that a lot of people are really going to resonate with that concept of grieving a culture that feels lost or even put on hold as you have to assimilate to a new reality. And I love how you're trying to bring your clients towards a sense of ease and pleasure and even rest in this radical way. And I was wondering, just for our listeners, like, are there a few things that maybe across the board that you tell people to kind of help guide them away from that deeply embedded sense of, I need to work really hard to deserve this? Is there anything that you can offer as a stepping stone to kind of move towards greater ease?
Well, there are a couple things. First of all, I think it is really important that people come to understand that there is a real, you know, a real state around loss and grief of culture, and that to name it, just even to name it, cultural bereavement is really powerful. We have found with just different folks we've worked with that it's almost as though once they hear those words and they kind of get an understanding of what we're talking about, a light bulb goes off. And it's like, that's what that is. That sort of nebulous weight that I can't really put my finger on and I've never heard about it before. That's what that is. It's huge. So I think that that's part of it. But another part of it too, and this is where I think that the challenge is behind this feeling of, oh, I don't know what I'm feeling. I don't know where this is coming from. I just know that it's just kind of heavy upon me. Some people have described it as just sort of like this, like, malaise.
Yeah.
Right? But it can really leave people feeling just very ungrounded. I would say sometimes confused, again, just because it's just such a nebulous kind of feeling. And I think because we can't put names to it and there's not recognition and acknowledgement, then there's a lot of isolation. There might also be, you know, shame, stigma, certainly. And so, again, getting back to the naming of it, that is important. But then I think to also understand, and I really suggest this notion of creating a resource map. And when I say that, what I mean is there are people in our lives who are resources. And when I'm talking about how are you resourced, it's that where, who, what do you want to eat, or what makes you feel really good? Who makes you feel really good? Where are the places in your neighborhood or in the world that just make you feel really good? What are the things that you do that make you feel really good? And I think that this notion of a resource map and really just taking some time to sit down and really come up with that for oneself, then I think it allows us to see, this is how I'm connected. And it might be that, you know what? I see that when I go out for a walk and maybe 6 in the morning when the air is really cool and it's really quiet, and that gives me a sense of grounding and peace, I need to do that more. And maybe if that just means I do it one more day a week, okay. But I also see on my resource map that this person, I love this person. I love the way that I feel when I'm with them. I love, you know, they're so wonderful. Then maybe making a conscious decision to either be with them more often or to talk with them more often, or, you know, things like that. I think that when we get into these silos of isolation, it is really easy to feel under-resourced. Absolutely. And, you know, our mind kind of plays tricks on us, like, oh, you know, like I don't have anything. And sometimes that actually may be true. But I still think that if that's the case, then there is something that we can also come back to. And I think that that's the idea of, you know, here it is, myself, let's start with breath, like breathing. How can I resource myself with breath work? And so it's things like that, where we need to become much more mindful of the different ways of how we can reach out, whether it's to people, to places, to books, to food, to whatever. But what makes me feel good? And let's go from there.
Mm, that's such a simple and such a big question, right? What makes me feel good? And when I hear that, you know, I can think of all the things that make me feel good, but there is an element I want to hold back. But is this okay? Like, this makes me feel good. I think there is that element of what you're saying. We have so much shame or discomfort about naming, this makes me feel good and I'll do this, and move away from the sense of, is this socially acceptable? Is this publicly acceptable to state that or do that? Because so much of grieving, I feel like, is done in private. I feel like you can tell by someone's gaze if they're grieving, but we don't talk about it. We don't acknowledge it. And especially cultural loss, it's so huge because you're so disconnected. And maybe that doesn't even mean like you want to go back to Thailand and somehow that grief, you know, will be replaced, right? So it's not even that easy to say, okay, go to a place. It's almost like that place doesn't exist. It just is suspended in memory, and the desire for it is suspended. And you're sort of searching for these clues. And I think I've seen that within people. I find that within people. Like, we may all be grieving different things, but I find like people who are grieving, like, that's my resource map, because those people get it. Like, there's a sense of, you know, softness and empathy, that humility that is so comforting and nourishing, I think, for me. And eating in community, of course. You know, sharing stories that probably light up something within someone else. So I think that nature of like commonality and finding points of connection, that as a resource sounds so helpful. I do want to follow up with what you said about creating a resource map. How are you doing that? It's such a beautiful framing. Like, what is your resource map and where you are in your life? And, you know, some 3-4 years after your parents being gone.
Yeah, no, thank you so much. Thank you for that wonderful question and allowing me, you know, to reflect. In terms of being here, I also have some friends with me. I have my friend, and here is a persimmon. And I'm bringing this friend in because my mother loved persimmons. And I also have a pomegranate here that I've cracked open. And, you know, there is actually a trick to cracking open pomegranates. I used to do it where I would just kind of, I don't know, like take a big old Asian cleaver and go right down the middle, walk, you know? And that is no good. The reason why is because it basically bruises the whole entire pomegranate. And so I actually had to learn.
It splatters it all over your kitchen counters, and the stain won't go away.
Yes.
And you have a pink stained kitchen.
That's right. And so there is a method, you know, to opening up these little treasures. But I remember whenever I have a pomegranate, I think back, because the first time I had a pomegranate was with my father. And he just loved all kinds of fruits. And he showed me how to open a pomegranate. And I think over time, quite frankly, like, I had forgotten. And so I have now revisited that, and I know how to open a pomegranate now. And so I have brought one with me. I would say for me, in terms of connection, and I think I have always known this about myself, is that I see and I understand the world through food. And so it's just really important to me, for example, if I am traveling someplace and I don't know anything about it, I really want to go to a farmer's market. Because in that way, I can be outside in nature. I can be going and just seeing, you know, what is local to this land and who are the people who are really working with this land and bringing forth basically like the most wonderful things from this land, even if I don't speak their language, in terms of, you know, pointing at different things and kind of doing like, I don't know, hand exchanges and smiles. Like you can get far with that. I really just love going and trying to understand what is, you know, what is the landscape of this place through the food that it bears. So yeah, returning to things like that. And then also, it's just been, I think that after my parents died, when I was just asking really, really just big questions about just what had just happened, as well as who am I, because I felt completely untethered. Unmoored at that time, I just realized that I perhaps had actually gained a different way of seeing because I was asking different kinds of questions. And so the idea of that became sort of intriguing as well as confusing and scary. And at that point, I mean, of course, I hadn't lost my parents at that, you know, ever before that. So this was like probably like the most challenging, just the most challenging state that I've ever had to be in and contend with. So in terms of just being kind of out there grasping at many, many different things, but understanding that perhaps I've been given a different way to see because my perception may have just shifted. What does that even mean? I just thought, okay, I think I have an opportunity now to maybe start exploring things I'd never really considered exploring before. And let's just see, what is that even going to do? What might that lead to? And I started out with this notion of different ways to see. And so that's when I actually, and I'm not an artist. I've never considered myself an artist, but I just decided I love color and maybe I can just start seeing something differently through color. And I picked up watercolor. And even now, I still don't paint. All I do is I play with my watercolor and I just paint color. And the beauty for me about watercolor is I love just watering my watercolor down to the point where the color is just barely there. And it's at that place where it is just barely there. And I'm asking myself, can I still see it? And what does it look like, you know, in this color light? What does it look like when there's not that much light? Those things to me kind of help me feel both curious as well as grounded. And it allows me to ask myself other questions about other things that I can explore. And also just about the nature of, like, the nature of curiosity, the nature of fear, the nature of just uncertainty. And in terms of dealing with that and being just kind of uncomfortable, it allows me to understand it's actually going to be okay. There might be this discomfort for now or whatnot, but that it will eventually either pass or, you know, subside or turn into something else. But that all of that is actually okay. I think that, you know, how to make, I think perhaps connections. The most important thing in my mind is like, again, like that connection to self, and perhaps connection to land, connection to nature. And I think that those are three jumping off points that there's a lot of exploration to be had there. And I think that in the process, maybe some answers, maybe you'll find some answers, who knows? But like the process of it alone is really invigorating, or can be scary as well. But that, like, the idea of like, I don't know what I'm going to find out, but I'm willing to try, is to me really exciting.
That's so gorgeous. Thank you so much for explaining to us the way that you
kind of categorize and organize your thoughts as you're grieving and feeling the sense of loss, because, you know, what's coming across to me is this sense of permission. Even saying cultural bereavement, you feel this weight lift off and you're like, oh, yes, there's a name for what I'm going through. And it gives you this sense of permission to explore it deeper. And even the simple question of what makes me feel good, it's such a varied jumping off point. It allows you so much discernment. And I love the fact that if you know what makes you feel good and you're really in touch with that, you can move towards those things without your brain getting in the way. Like, it made me think of how even the story that you said about your parents splurging and going out to eat at Thai restaurants that are really good, like, that reminds me of, like, one of the things that makes me feel really good is eating Italian food. And, like, a lot of times my brain will be like, I don't have money to go out to eat, and I'll just shut it down. But if I look at it in the lens of, like, this is one of my touchstones, like, this makes me feel good, and that will get me one step closer to healing, then that's worth it. It's not just something you just shut down. And for you, I see that allowing yourself to kind of dive into what makes you feel connected and tethered and even just good, you've been able to enter these really subtle realms. I love how you explain the process with your watercolors. Like, you can really use this framework to go quite deep. So thank you for sharing that with all of our listeners.
And Rebecca's essentially saying, please eat more pasta. It's good for your health. And I agree.
It's good for your soul.
It is. It is good for your soul.
I'm going to see Rebecca after like a 30-hour flight. So I asked her, do you have your sister come do a massage? Can I have ginger tea? Can I have pasta? I'm already ordering my menu. Nurturing on my arrival.
I love that. In fact, so, you know, I think it's sort of this notion of like a resource map. It should be a menu of nurturing. Ooh, I love that.
Yeah, I would say the tasting menu for me.
We all need that.
All of the above.
Yeah, we do all need that.
Tita, you are so creative. You're very humble, I'll say that. You have so many gifts, and it's been so beautiful to like see you kind of, you know, take up watercoloring or sound healing, all these like different beautiful modalities. But I'm wondering, you know, maybe for a lot of people who come to your circles are so new to this, like they wouldn't even know where to start, especially we're talking as like families of the people of the diaspora who are like, you know, we don't invest in those kinds of things. You know, if you're struggling, you just choose not to struggle. You put on a face and, you know, you go out and, you know, be strong. But how you're framing, there's such like, you know, almost this like shattering fragility in the most beautiful way, because our spirits are so fragile, and you're framing that, you know, it's okay to be fragile. It's okay to enjoy that. It's okay to be in community and like celebrate that fragility, because in a way, like our parents didn't get to be fragile. They didn't get to, you know, feel sad and sort of like linger in that space. And you're, like Rebecca said, giving permission for us to do that. I'm curious, when people gather in your sort of dinners, I saw you had a beautiful, you know, the Korean Harvest Moon dinner or other dinners you've hosted. What are people's like reflections? Like, what are they saying? Are they just shocked and surprised? Or is there, you know, do they just like start opening up in a way they haven't been? Because again, like, we just don't have spaces to arrive as we are and say, I'm so alone and I need people in my life. I wonder, how are people receiving what you're creating?
There's so many ironies, there's so many paradoxes. I think that when we're carrying around so much, and we are carrying around so much, the world is a crazy place. I think what happens is that, you know, with the weight of things, and I don't know whether it's so much like this notion of like, you know, compressing this notion of like our soul. But under the weight of things, I think that there is tremendous pressure and there is this compression. And I think that what ends up happening actually is like that is what may very well make us like brittle. And I think that it isn't until there can potentially be a release. And not only a release, but also finding that, yes, I'm not alone because I might be able to witness other people's stories and understand that our stories might be different, our experiences might be different, but in terms of what we're actually contending with, that that's the same. It's that power also of community that, again, starts to feed that compressed soul. I think that it's really only until we can find either the places or the spaces or the people with whom we feel safe and that we can be, you know, raw and open and vulnerable and just cracked open, that that's also when being able to release so that something else can come in. That's where we really begin to develop, I would say, this notion of our own abundance, our own true resilience. And so I think that in the spaces that we have been holding, yeah, it's actually, it is a place, I think, where people feel like they can just kind of like, like, you know, rest for a moment. And that if they choose to, you know, they can share something, but they can also listen to what others might be sharing and to bear witness. And all of this is hard work. I think that people are just so, they need a lot of space and they need safe space in order for them themselves to be able to release something, which in itself takes a great amount of courage in today's world. It's so counterintuitive, but the spaces, you know, are not, there aren't enough of them. And in terms of oneself having the capacity to, you know, one, show up, make time for oneself in order to do that. And then beyond that, like muster up the courage, perhaps to release something. It's a huge endeavor. It really is. But I would say that that huge endeavor is actually only met by, you know, sort of like this corresponding force that if you keep it in, if you aren't able to find places of release for it, just to like let the pressure off a little bit, but that if you keep it in, if you're holding it in, you are compressing it, you are compounding it. And no matter what, it comes out in ways. You don't know how, but it does. It comes out in its way because it has to. And so being able to find, you know, safe spaces in which someone can really just rest for a moment and release something, whatever they need to. And it doesn't mean that, oh, this goes away or that I'm cured, quote unquote, or whatnot. No, it just means that, you know, you just opened yourself up to a little bit more capacity. And then from here, there might actually be a little bit more possibility. When we are in places where there very well might be what we'd like to call like mirrors for reflection, but then also potentially like windows in which we can see possibility, then once you leave those places, perhaps if you do have a little bit more capacity and you have been able to see these mirrors and these windows, and you yourself might be able to see a different possibility, that's huge.
That's so beautiful. Thank you, Tita. We're coming to a close pretty soon here, and I want to ask you the question that we ask everyone on this podcast. What is your grief craving?
My grief craving, it's changed. It's definitely changed. I would say if you'd asked me that, maybe like I would say perhaps in like the first 2 years after my parents had died, there was just so much just longing around being again at the table with them. You know, that if I just could one more, you know, have one more meal. And there's that. But I feel like my grief craving now more so is really around really trying to identify my own self. And I don't mean that, you know, in perhaps like this like self-centered or narcissistic way or something like that. That's not what I mean. But what I just understand is that if I can't find myself, if there aren't, you know, the tethers within myself to which I can come home, in which I can walk this earth grounded, then I can't show up. And that's not something that I really understood before my parents died. I thought I was showing up. And it was because I was working hard. I was, you know, I had all these to-do lists. I was busy, busy, busy. I was, you know, running things, and I was going to meetings and just, again, all that. But I really needed to take, time in order to reflect. And I do think that that was pretty much one of the final gifts from my parents in their passing, kind of like knocking, hey, you, cut it out. You need to see something differently. And so, yeah, I think that my grief craving now is more around, how do I recognize what are the losses that I have been carrying, that I carry? How do I learn how to metabolize that for myself so that I can continue to just carry it forward, to be with it? And the question comes back as to, well, why is that necessary? It's necessary because I need to come to some kind of understanding with myself, which is, you know, that's an ever changing process, but at least for this moment or whatnot, where am I? Because it's the idea of being just grounded so that I can show up for myself and then I can show up for others.
And I hope you find that journey of like finding yourself and giving yourself the space to rest, to grieve, and, you know, build community around it, which you're already doing so beautifully. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Tita, and bringing along, you know, those beautiful memories with your parents and the pomegranate and the persimmon. It's so vibrant. Our conversation was so tender, but also so vibrant. And I hope, you know, people take that away, is that our culture does offer that lens of vibrancy, is a place where we can grab beauty and connection to something that is life affirming and wondrous. So thank you for illuminating that and doing that work. We're so excited to see you in person very soon and, you know, just soak in more of Tita's energy. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to when we're all going to be able to eat together.
And Tita, can you tell our listeners where they can find you, how they might be able to work with you?
Oh, absolutely. So our Instagram handle is Meso Community, M-E-S-O Community. And then we have a website, www.mesocommunity.com.
Amazing. Thank you so much for being on our show today. And we look forward to talking to you again soon.
Not soon enough. Thank you.
If you haven't already, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. And don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at wearemarigold.com so you can be the first to know when new episodes drop.
You can also find us at We Are Marigold on Substack and Instagram. And we would love to hear from our listeners. You drop us an email, direct messages, share your food story, ask us questions. Do you want advice? Do you want recipe ideas? Or even let us know, what is your grief craving?